The Catcher in the Rye was written, of course, by J.D. Salinger, famously reclusive, but known as Jerry to his friends. This isn't about that book, not directly at least. Instead, it's the story of a young woman who worked at one of New York's most prestigious literary agencies. And she was warned about Jerry. Don't talk to him, don't talk about him, don't give out his details to the press. Joanna Rakoff is a poet, novelist and journalist. And she's written an account of her time protecting Jerry from the world. It's called My Salinger Year. She spoke to Michael Cathcart recently, beginning with what she did and didn't know about The Catcher in the Rye.
At the time, I don't know what things are like in academia now, and it may be different outside of the States, but Salinger was not considered a serious writer who was worthy of academic study. He was thought of as a kind of popular writer. If I had proposed writing, say, my honors thesis at what you would call university on Salinger, I think my advisor would have thought I was insane. So I had this idea, and this was partly just the times. It was the 90s, you know, and writers like, say, Martin Amis were very popular. Someone like Mary Gateskill, people who were sort of writing gritty urban fictions, you know, in which people were like doing drugs and having sex in alleyways and like doing these, you know, terrible things. And Salinger's stories were kind of perceived as charming, archaic, outmoded, not by everyone, of course, but this was the perception that I had, that they were these kind of mass market entertainment that were cute. I thought that they were all going to be about precocious children.
Yeah. So to Norman Rockwell for art school.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. That is so perfect.
Yeah, but yes. That's what it was like. So, okay, so you enter this the hushed tones, the hushed world of this agency, and you're very vivid in the way you describe your office space. Really, you're just working, it seems to me, in the corridor pretty much outside your boss's office in a little kind of nook.
Sort of. It was actually, the office was very large. The agency, so the agency's heyday had been, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, oh, the 20s and 30s too, but it was a couple of decades in the past, but they still had this whole floor of a Madison Avenue building, not a super fancy building, but still a Madison Avenue building, very valuable real estate. My boss kind of had a wing to herself, and she had her big, fancy office, and then there was just a room outside it, a pretty large room, and I just kind of had a space in that large room.
Yeah. On your desk, there was no computer. There were no answering machines. I mean, what this is the wonderful part. You had this old-fashioned, I mean, it was electric, typewriter.
And yeah, it was still pretty old-fashioned, Michael. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's cut to the chase here. There you are with your big electric typewriter, your telephone, no fax machine, no email, nothing. The rest of the world has moved into this era, we should say, but not at your agency. And your job, part of your job anyway, is to field calls and deal with letters from people who are desperate to contact Salinger, Jerry, the author of Catcher in the Rye, who's notoriously private. So what sort of things would they say? And who are they? Who are these people who want to get in touch with J.D. Salinger?
They were all over the map. There were a lot of them, as you can imagine. And the letters came from all over the world. I was honestly shocked. I did not understand the reach of Salinger. I mean, on my first day, there was a letter from Sri Lanka. It's like, really? A lot of letters from Japan, Thailand, tons of letters from Scandinavia, very popular in Scandinavia, but everywhere, every country in the world, every part of the United States. And the letters ran the gamut. So some were kind of typical, adoring fan mail. There were a lot of letters from young Japanese girls, often on Hello Kitty stationery. Sometimes the letters would come one letter in English, one letter in Japanese, thinking maybe he could read Japanese. I don't know. But just sort of saying, you know, dear Mr. Salinger, I love your work. So that was the sort of very basic, simple fan letter. But then the letters that really affected me sort of fell into a few categories. There were the crazy people, who were sending these kind of ranting, like Unabomber mad ravings about whatever they were. And those were actually the letters that were kind of the reason that I was actually supposed to look through all the letters rather than just sending these form letters back to fans without even reading the letters. They were worried that someone like Mark David Chapman, you know, who shot John Lennon, someone like that was going to write to Salinger and we were going to need to report it to the FBI. So there were indeed some letters that I had to pass on to my superior saying this person seems crazy. He's included a lock of his own hair in this letter.
Right.
And it appears to be written in his own blood.
Now, this wasn't paranoid because Chapman himself, the man who shot Lennon, had an obsession with Catcher in the Rye.
Exactly. There was no paranoia. This was very real. And crazy people really did and do become obsessed with Salinger.
Yeah.
This was a real, you know, concern. And in fact, Salinger had part of the reason Salinger stopped answering his own fan mail was because he was getting death threats. And people were threatening his children, who were tiny at the time. It freaked him out, understandably.
They're not all Maddies, though. You've got heartfelt letters as
right.
well, both from teenagers and from war veterans who really do identify with his own war experience.
Exactly, yes. There's the teenagers who are writing either in the voice of Holden Caulfield, as in, "Dear Jerry, you old bastard, I'd get one hell of a kick out of it if you'd write back and call me a crumb bun," you know, that kind of thing. Or writing Jerry to say, "Holden Caulfield is the only character in literature that is like me. You know, how did you get inside my head to understand me?" And I hate all books, you know, other than The Catcher in the Rye, a lot of that.
Mm.
And there were the veterans saying, you know, I read your books when they first came out, and now all these years later, I'm retired and I'm rereading them, and you so perfectly captured my experiences, and often recounting their experiences, which were horrible, you know, their friends dying in their arms. And then there were the letters that I thought of as the tragic letters, and there were a lot of these, which were letters from people who had undergone really difficult experiences, a child dying. There were a lot about children dying, honestly, sometimes adult children dying, people losing children, basically, but also sometimes just, you know, a spouse passing away, not just, but, you know, things are slightly less tragic.
So you're dealing with very intimate experiences and very heartfelt emotions. And your job, Joe, is to do something pretty callous, really. You've just got to send back the same letter to everybody, a form letter that says, "Dear Miss whoever you are, thank you for your recent letter. As you may know, Mr. Salinger does not wish to receive mail from his readers. Thus, we cannot pass on your kind note to him. We thank you for your interest in Mr. Salinger's books. Best, the agency." I mean, it is a real, you know, go away and get a life kind of letter. But you actually, despite your clear instructions just to send that letter, get involved in some of these people.
Exactly. I found it really difficult to send that letter, particularly to the people who were writing about these awful experiences, these kind of confessional letters. Here again, veterans saying, "I too was at the Battle of the Bulge. No one should see the sort of horrible things that I saw," or people talking about losing their children and Salinger helping them through this year or two of grief. It just was hard to send back a letter that said Mr. Salinger does not want to see his fan mail. And because I was 23 and earnest, there was part of me that thought, I know he doesn't want to see his fan mail, but he might want to see this letter.
You know, you don't come across as earnest the way you tell the story. You come across as compassionate.
Mm.
Which is not a bad thing, Joe. I mean,
yeah, it's true. It's true. I kept putting myself in the place of these people and thinking, if I were this lady, you know, whose daughter died at age 19 and it was her only child, she's left alone, and her daughter's favorite story was A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, you know, I would want a letter back. I wouldn't want a letter that just said, "Go away. Don't ever think about Salinger again, or we'll come and find you and kill you." You know,
That's right. So, Joe, tell us about the first time you actually spoke to Salinger. He called. He phoned.
He did. I was told that he would never call, and that was not true. He called. Basically, I picked up my phone. So, as you mentioned, there was no voicemail at this agency. There was a receptionist, and if she wasn't there, the phones just rang all over the office, and you were supposed to pick one up. So the receptionist was under strict instructions to only put Salinger through to my boss, and I was told that this is what would happen, that he would only get put through to my boss if he called, which he would not. So one day, it was a Friday, and my boss was at home. She, in quotes, worked at home on Fridays. And I pick up the phone, and there's just someone shouting, you know, rah, rah, rah. I couldn't understand. It was sort of gibberish. It sounded like someone was shouting from very far away. Like maybe they were called. This is still the 90s. So there still was that feeling of like, this is someone calling from Australia or somewhere. Like the line was not good, you know. And so I was trying to figure out what was going on. I actually thought it might be a crazy Salinger fan because they did call. And then slowly, as the person kept shouting over and over again, I realized that he was saying, it's Jerry. It's Jerry. And that the reason that his voice sounded strange was because he had the kind of garbled speech of someone who is deaf. Now, I, of course, had no idea that Salinger had any hearing problems at all, really, or not to that extent. And once he got through to me and sort of understood who I was, he was disoriented. I think, thought he was being put through to my boss, but my boss wasn't there. So for some reason, the receptionist put him through to me. And once he understood that I was the assistant, he thought my name was Suzanne. That was fine. And once he got that I was Suzanne, the assistant, then he calmed down. He started speaking in a more normal voice and I could understand him. And he was very nice, actually.
So in the story, we won't give this all away because I hope people do get the book and read it because it's such an enjoyable read. But you eventually do meet him face to face and he comes into the office. But I don't think he really ever knows quite who you are. You're just the girl of the office, really.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. It's funny. I definitely felt that way myself. And yet at the same time, I had been given these strict instructions to never keep him on the phone. Don't make conversation. If he gets put through to you, don't make conversation with him. Don't chat with him. Don't ask him any questions. Don't talk to him about your life. And I was pretty shy and there was no way that I would have done so even if my boss hadn't given me those instructions. But he would sort of make me a bit uncomfortable because he would ask me questions about my life. So he figured out that I wrote, first he figured out that I read poetry, then he figured out that I wrote poetry, and he would call and make these comments and say, you know, what one day the receptionist was gone and I answered the phones for the whole agency. And he said, they have you answering phones? Why are you answering phones? You're a poet. Don't get stuck answering phones. You're not a receptionist. You're not a secretary. At the time, I did not feel this way. But as the years have gone by, I realized that to a very tiny extent, I was an actual human to him, you know, differentiated from other humans. And I've also realized that he didn't talk to that many people. And that's maybe part of the reason that I did become a human for him.
Also, writers develop a kind of intimacy with their agent. It's a strange relationship because the agent becomes like a kind of parent.
Yes.
That's caring for you. So you feel loved by the people in your agent's office.
Oh, you do. I mean, my agent has had the same assistant the whole time that I've been with her. And she's become an actual friend of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah, she knows everything about my life.
Now, let's
everything.
Talk about the tough issue that you've raised in this book. I mean, a tough ethical issue. Your job at the agency was all about privacy, about keeping confidences. That's what agents do. Now, how do your former employers feel about you opening up their private world in this way? Because, Joe, it's not hard to work out who this agency is or who this boss was. Lots of people have figured it out. The agency is Harold Ober Associates. Your boss was Phyllis Westberg. She's still alive. You can find out all about her on the internet. There's no secret, actually, that you've been able to keep in this story. You've opened up a private world to the public gaze.
It's true. I have. Yeah. And the agency I happen to know has not changed very much. So they have not embraced technology at all, much, you know, honestly, to their detriment. They're dramatically reduced in size and in revenue, as far as I know. And they've lost a lot of agents.
Okay, but what's the answer to the question? I mean, you have violated confidence, haven't you, by writing this book?
I suppose I have. I had already revealed these things, though, in essays. I wrote these two essays that led to this book. and that, you know, had a pretty wide audience. One was for Slate, which has millions of readers. And I also put together a documentary for BBC Radio 4.
And it's a fantastic documentary, and listeners might like to find it. It's a wonderful story. But the fact that you've done it often doesn't make it right. I mean, you know, if I were a client of an agency and then 20 years later, I don't want to be rude, but the girl who answered the phone started revealing what I'd thought was private confidences and wrote a book about it, I think I might be a bit cheesed off.
But I didn't really reveal any private confidences. You know, the conversations, if you're referring to Salinger specifically, the conversations that I had with him, you know, were pretty pedestrian. The things that are revealed are more about me than about him. It wasn't like he said, oh, you know, did you read my daughter's memoir? You know how she says I drank my own urine? I didn't really do it. You know, I mean, it wasn't like he was revealing that much to me. I mean, I do reveal more stuff about the agency. There's not much revealed about any clients. I mean, almost nothing.
No, that's true. You do reveal what's like at the agency. Have you had any feedback from your former colleagues? Do you know whether they're thrilled that you've had this big success?
Well, I have. A few have written to me. I interviewed many of them in writing the book. So many of them knew about it. Many of the people who are characters in the book knew all about it and were completely on board with it. There's a character named Max who eventually left the agency, interviewed him extensively. He wrote and said, oh, my God, you did it. It's so great. I love it. And others have contacted me as well. One person, there's another assistant in the book who's referred to as Olivia, and she wrote and said, you know, I'd love to get coffee with you sometime and catch up. I haven't spoken to her since 1996. And then said, basically, I describe her in pretty, I thought, positive ways. She was very beautiful, and I describe her as that way. And, you know, but I say at one point that she was a terrible assistant. And I thought that she was okay with this because she didn't seem to care that much. She admitted at the time that she didn't care. She hated the job, but she didn't like being described that way.
Yeah.
As far as my boss goes, I did not speak to her. I did not attempt to speak to her. I don't know what she thinks about the book or if she's read it. She did, however, read one of the two essays I wrote on the subject, and it was reported back to me that she was tickled by
it. Phyllis was tickled.
You can listen to a longer version of that interview online. Joanna Rakoff's book is called My Salinger Year, and this is Books Plus on RN.
G'day, it's Michael Cathcart here from Books and Arts Daily. On the final Friday of each month, you and I get together to discuss a classic European novel. And this month's book is The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. It's a short and intense book about a travelling salesman who wakes up one day and discovers that he has been transformed into a giant insect. It's weird and wonderful. So do start reading, and we'll discuss it on Books and Arts on the last Friday of the month.